safe. Ain't gonna change. Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly program whose purpose is to analyze major economic events and trends, the forces both domestic and international that shape our jobs, our income, our taxes, our debts, what we can and cannot afford to buy, the way we live, the way, in short, our economic system works. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life. I currently teach in the graduate program for international affairs here at the New School University in Manhattan, from where this program is coming. I also write regularly for the service truthout.org, a courageous source of daily news and news analysis. Do check out their website at truthout.org. And also, please keep sending us your questions, your comments. We read each and every one of them because they help us shape our program. We can select only a few because of time limits that we answer towards the end of each hour, and I will do that again today, of course. Send them, as always, please, to democracyatwork.info. That's the website to use for your questions and comments, and thank you for sending them. Today we will have a guest. I will introduce him as usual about 15 minutes or so into the hour. I'm going to begin with our updates. And first and most important, I want to spend a few minutes celebrating a little bit of a David and Goliath story, but this time we're going to call it Cyprus and Goliath. Cyprus is a very small country, about 1 million people, occupying an island in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea. But they've been in the news over the last week or so because of something extraordinary and important, but not just for Cyprus, for everyone in the world, so it's important to pay real close attention, which I've tried to do. The 1 million people on Cyprus really have only three basic industries. Tourism, people from northern parts of Europe that are cold and wet often for the winter, love to go to places like Cyprus because it's balmy and it's warm, etc. So they have a tourism business. Secondly, as befits an island nation, they have a business of shipping. But the most important business, in a way, has been what they there call, euphemistically, finance. What they mean is banks. And what the banks on Cyprus did, private banks, was to spend the last 20 years collecting deposits from people around the world who needed a place where they could convert their local currency into euros, because Cyprus is part of Europe, and from there have a euro account with which to pay their bills. This proved to be particularly attractive to Russian big businesses and Russian people whose businesses are, let's say, somewhat shady, who could convert their rubles into euros, get a nice interest rate in a Cypriot bank, and from there do all their business as if they were a regular European business dealing in euros. The banks in Cyprus loved it because they got a lot of deposits. How many? Well, to give you an idea, this year the total deposits in Cyprus's banks were 5 times the total GDP of Cyprus. That's absurd. That's crazy. That's a tail wagging the proverbial economic dog. The banks in Cyprus were collecting money from depositors in Cyprus, but mostly from outside of Cyprus, and then doing what banks are supposed to do, taking their depositors' money and carefully and prudently investing it and hoping to make more money with their depositors' investments than they had to pay to the depositors to get it. But of course, banks are supposed to be careful. They're custodians of other people's money. Well, let's see, how did they do in Cyprus? They did disastrously. It turns out that the bankers of Cyprus took their depositors' money and invested it in ways that turned out to be bad, weak. They lost a good bit of that money, partly because of the economic crisis that affected all banks, and partly because they did a particularly poor job. Meanwhile, Cyprus's economy over the last few years has had terrible troubles. for the same reason, the global capitalist crisis. Europeans can't afford vacations the way they used to, so the tourism industry of Cyprus suffers. World trade has contracted terribly during this crisis of the last 5 years, so the shipping industry of Cyprus is in trouble. Well, you're a little country, you're a poor country, you do tourism, shipping, and banking, and all three sectors are damaged by the crisis. Result? Cyprus is in a disaster situation. The banks will have to declare bankruptcy, and that's their biggest industry, because they can't get back, from the way they invested the money their depositors gave them. So what did the banks do, having failed in their function as private capitalist banks? They did what banks everywhere, in Europe, in the United States, and elsewhere did. They rushed to the government to bail them out. And so the Cyprus government tried to do that. And they went to the Europeans, who've been bailing out the Greeks, the Irish, the Portuguese, and are now navigating the Spanish and Italian crises. And they said, give us some money. But because Cyprus is so small, the amount of money isn't significant. So you might have expected the Europeans to give them the same sort of deal. And here's the deal. We'll give you some money, but you got to whack your own people with austerity. You got to raise taxes on your own people to help pay back what we're going to lend you. And you have to stop social programs for your people to save up money you're going to have to use to pay us back for us helping you through your crisis. In other words, the economic crisis not caused by the average people, the bailout not benefiting the average people, is now going to cost the average people in an austerity program. That's happening everywhere in the world. But now hear what the Cypriotic people had to face. For the first time, the Europeans demanded, and the Cyprus government agreed, that in part of payment for this loan, here's what would happen. The banks of Cyprus would unilaterally, over the last weekend, remove 10% of the bank deposits of all people and institutions that had more than 100,000 euros in their account. 10% would be taken from them, roughly. From people with less than 100,000, all the little people of Cyprus, they would discover Monday of this last week, the 18th of March, that they had 6.5% roughly less money in their account than they thought they had when they went to sleep Friday night. This is a new development of austerity. This means more than taxing people, which you can try to work around, cutting government spending, which you can try to work around. Here you can't escape. Your money is literally being snatched from you. This has not been done before, anywhere. And the people of Cyprus rose up over the weekend and said no. And the government that agreed, unagreed. It is a very profound illustration of how mass action by abused populations, abused by a capitalism that doesn't work, by an austerity program that doesn't fix the problem, saying, you're not going to make us pay. And so all the politicians, doing what all the banks wanted, failed. And the people said no. And now they're running around trying to figure out what to do. Two more comments on this important Cyprus event. Because it's not just a victory for people saying, no, you can't make the average person pay for the failure of an economic system and the failure of a bailout that went only to those at the top. When the banks agreed to take their own depositors' money and give it to the government, let's all remember what the government was going to do with it. A large portion of that money was to help the banks through their difficulty. It's called in financial language recapitalizing the banks. The government would have taken a part of the money it took from the depositors in the bank and given it to the bank to restore its profitability and to restore its reserves. So let's be clear. This program was a way for the government to serve banks by taking away the depositors' money to repay the bank for having failed to adequately invest those depositors' money. If you're scratching your head in disbelief, good. You've understood what's at stake here. Let me turn to a few other economic updates. before we turn to our guest. First, I wanted to present you with how the world looks from the other point of view. And this time I wanted to congratulate the president of the Wells Fargo Company, one of the largest banks in the United States, and particularly a bank involved in the mortgage business, where so many Americans have been losing their homes because they can't come up with the money to stay in the homes, even though they've paid, in some cases, for many years. How is the president, the chief executive of Wells Fargo, doing? His name, John Strumpf. And here's what he's going to be getting in his last year's full salary. Ready? $19.3 million in compensation when you add up his bonus, his performance-based stock grants, and his salary. So I did a little calculation. That's what we economists do. And here's what that works out to. On a 52-week year basis, Mr. Strumpf takes home, ready, $371,154 per week. You may have people losing their homes, you may have people struggling, but you also have people in this world who come to work and go home at the end of the week and each week pocket $371,154 in a time of crisis. No wonder that the annual stockholder meeting of Wells Fargo this year will be held on April 23rd in Salt Lake City, Utah. Last year, the bank held its annual meeting in San Francisco, where it's based, which makes a certain sense. But there were so many demonstrators angry at how the bank performs that this year they've moved it to Salt Lake City, which is a friendlier environment. And when I checked into it, I found out that Goldman Sachs has also scheduled its annual meeting in Salt Lake City this spring. Let me turn also to the housing market in the United States. There's been some news recently about a recovery in the housing market. Let's be real careful and understand what's going on. I wanted to take a look at the basics of the housing industry. Here's what I discovered. Half, 50% of the total number of homes privately owned in the United States, individual houses, co-op apartments, condominiums, half of them, either owe more on their home than the house is now worth or the home is now worth. That's in, they have negative equity. They not only own nothing of their house, what they own is worth less than what they own. Or they have just enough more that they are in a terrible place, but they have a little bit of equity. Only half of the people have a significant amount of equity. That is, a significant portion of the house they actually own. And then I looked at the housing industry as a whole, and here's what I found. If you average across all Americans with all of their homes, the average amount of your home that American homeowners own is 31%, right? The other 69% of your home is owned by the bank that you owe money to. Americans are not homeowners. We ought to call them what they are, one-third. Homeowners. You own less than a third of your houses on average. Two-thirds are owned by the bank. That's because of the economic crisis and what it has done to housing values and to the ability of people to pay their mortgages. It is a housing system in crisis. My final economic update for today has a certain humor to it, but also a lesson about our capitalist system. Over the last week, a number of companies, DrJ's.com and Eminent, but perhaps the most famous, the Neiman Marcus department store, pleaded guilty and reached an arrangement in which they acknowledged that the fake fur garments they were selling, and why fake fur? Because People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals and many others have been protesting for years against the slaughter of animals to create decorative garments. So these companies, to make more money, to get more customers, and to avoid irritating PETA and other groups like that, have decided to promote faux fur, fake fur, artificial fur garments. But what did we discover in the remarkable way capitalism works? These companies that I mentioned admitted last week that what they had labeled as fake fur was in fact real fur. It was fur particularly of rabbits and raccoons that was used because it's cheaper than the fake fur and so made more money from what actually the garment cost. The way capitalist enterprises make money are extraordinary. And this story is another example. Let me turn now to my guest and introduce him to you and welcome him to the program. His name is Keith Harrington. So thank you, Keith, first of all, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Let me begin by introducing to our audience Keith Harrington. He is the founder of a group in Maryland and Washington, D.C. He was the field director. It's called the Chesapeake Climate Action Network, a mid-Atlantic-based climate and clean energy group that 350.org founder Bill McKimmon has called the following, the best regional climate organization in the world. That's quite an accolade for a group that this guest today has a crucial role in working with. He also is on the board of the New Economics Institute. We're going to be talking about that in a few minutes. And finally, while he pursues his master's degree in economics at the New School for Social Research in New York City, he also writes regularly for several publications, including Truthout, Grist.org, Alternet, and the Huffington Post. So again, Keith, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Let me begin by asking you to tell our audience and me what the New Economics Institute is, what it is trying to do, and then let's have a conversation about the purposes, the goals, the problems you see.
Absolutely. The New Economics Institute is an organization that is focusing on trying to develop a national movement around what we call new economics. Now, for those who aren't familiar with the term, new economics is an idea about reorienting our economic system. It's based on the realization that the priorities of our current system are completely out of whack, that we need system change, that we need to move in a more democratic and sustainable direction for our economy. The current economy has several major flaws that we're trying to address in the financial system. We have a financial system that is oriented towards building the profits of Wall Street as opposed to investing in Main Street and growing sustainable, thriving communities. We have a profound lack of democracy in our economic system, as you well know and you yourself organize around. We also have a poor orientation towards the biosphere, towards our relationship with nature. We see it in our current economic system as something to be exploited, as something to boost short-term profits through exploitation, as opposed to something that is actually sustaining our economy. So we want to turn that around in the new economic movement to have a financial system that boosts the wealth of our communities, to have workplaces that are run democratically, to realize that we need what we would call a triple bottom line approach to doing business, as opposed to just putting profit above people in the planet, realizing that profit should be serving communities, that it should be serving the people in those companies, and that we should be investing in a sustainable ecosystem.
Tell me, to whom are you targeting your efforts? In other words, is there a part of the population that the New Economic Institute is most focused on, and if so, who are they?
Well, this is a movement that, you know, we hope to go to reach every segment of society. You know, we see this as cutting across cultural, political, institutional boundaries. In terms of mobilizing particular demographics, we are particularly trying to go after communities, individuals that have been marginalized by the current economy, to help them grow economies locally that are able to serve their needs in the way that our corporate, globally focused economy is not able to do. So, for instance, there's an organization called Transition Towns. Transition Towns is working to try to provide people with local economic models that can help them create services that aren't being provided them by the fact that our political system no longer is able to raise the funds to invest in public infrastructure and so forth, to the fact that jobs are being shipped overseas and there is a lack of a revenue to pay for things as well.
I understand that part of your activity has to do with colleges and universities in the United States and the role they play in the kinds of economic change you think are necessary. Could you tell us a little bit about what you're concerned about in the colleges and universities and what kinds of activities you're mounting there?
Absolutely. So our work at in the New Economics Institute right now is focusing on trying to create a national network of student organizations, student groups that will try to implement these new economic ideas on campuses. The reason why we decided that we needed to build a movement like this is, basically we can look at what we saw with the Occupy movement. The Occupy movement, we saw this upsurge of interest across the country in system change. There were questions that came along with that, and that is, what would a new economic system look like? How could we implement it? What are some of the key institutions of it? And these questions are questions that we need a strong intellectual base in order to answer. Unfortunately, we don't have the intellectual tools that we really need in our public discourse to address these questions of innovation and coming up with alternative models. When a lot of people looked at the Occupy movement, they asked themselves, well, what is it that you're really asking for? You know, what is an economy beyond capitalism? Are you just talking about state socialism? Are you talking about communism? So we are hoping with this movement to create pressure on campuses from students to say, look, we're being taught about economics and we have these challenges that we're facing in the 21st century. There's a lot of people interested in system change, so we need to make sure that there are folks doing research on new economic ideas to help bolster this growing movement with academic and intellectual tools.
Well, I have to say, Keith, you have your work cut out for you. Because I'm a victim or a survivor of the American college and university system of teaching economics. That's what I do all my life. I'm still doing it. And I must tell you that with the exception of a very few departments of economics in American colleges and universities, it is not a profession that believes its obligation is to teach a variety of intellectual perspectives or to feel that it ought to help students understand how to make basic economic change. If anything, the economics profession is the opposite. It doesn't believe in change, basically. It teaches an economics that takes the existing system for granted as the basic framework, that there will be no change, needs to be no change. The language of conventional economics is full of notions of optimum and equilibrium and all kinds of notions that are deeply embedded in the notion that what we have is the best there is, and we can tinker and fix and adjust, but change isn't relevant. So you're going to have to really work hard to change the climate of the university to make it serve the goal of opening students up to the idea there could be change, what are the alternative kinds of change, what are the pros and cons of alternative systems to the one we have. That's going to take quite a bit of work, and I wonder how you react to that description of the countryside, in a sense, that you're hoping to transform.
It is a challenge, and we're under no illusion that this is something, transformation that we can somehow affect in the very short run. There's a history of the marginalization of heterodox economic thought in this country that we definitely have to fight back against. This goes back to the McCarthy era, when there were communist and socialist witch hunts occurring. This process has, as I said, robbed us of a huge part of our intellectual heritage. One of the things that shocks me the most as an economics student is the fact our professors remind us all the time, this institution is special, the New School for Social Research is special, and that it's one of a few remaining heterodox economics departments. And that is heterodox being outside of the orthodoxy and teaching things that, for instance, don't fall into the neoclassical framework as you were just describing. And the process of purging heterodox teachers and economics departments has continued since that era, since the McCarthy era. And there's actually a very interesting book out recently by Marjorie Hines. It's called Priests of Our Democracy. And this work talks about, you know, the history of the purges that occurred since the McCarthy era. It says that they basically continue down to the present day. We've seen continuing attacks on professors who like to challenge the status quo, who are left-leaning, who are considered radical. There is a culture of fear among professors. If they want to gain tenure, they simply cannot feel that they cannot speak out and be radical and critical of the status quo. A couple of years ago, there was the University of Notre Dame had a heterodox department that shut down. Some professors have been targeted by right-wing smear campaigns to try to get them kicked out. So what I'm suggesting is that this is definitely an ongoing process. It comes down to the fact that just as our political system is under the control of corporate money, is influenced by corporate money, unfortunately, our educational system is suffering from the same lack of funding for professors and for types of economic thought departments that that are outside the mainstream that challenge the status quo. So it's definitely a big challenge, as you've suggested.
I would also add that it's very short-sighted. You know, if you don't teach people how to think critically about your economic system, you've cut yourself off from the insights of critics that can also often be crucial to solving the problems of an economic system.
Absolutely.
One of the reasons we presumably in America encourage debate about our education system, our transportation system. We've just had 2 years of debate about our national health system and how we ensure the well-being health-wise of our people. We can improve the systems that come together to make our society, but we can only improve them if we talk honestly about their strengths and weaknesses. In economics, we haven't been able to have a core of people in university positions to do the research, the thinking, the writing, the speaking, to present the criticisms of our system, to help us figure out what's going wrong and how to make it better. And we live now in an economic system that I believe shows the results of having no critics and no fixing and no debate about the strengths and weaknesses of capitalism. If you don't debate it, if you give capitalism a pass, they're free to indulge these capitalists, all their worst instincts. That's why some people get $371,000 a week as a salary, where other people can't send their kids to school without loading them up with a level of debt that will hamper the rest of their lives. This is a system that isn't working well, and one of the reasons we're not good at fixing it now, why this depression that we're in has lasted 7 years, is we don't have a core of critical thinking that might have helped pinpoint what was wrong, what needed to be fixed, what changes had to be made. So we're paying a price for the narrow-mindedness of economics education in this country. It's a kind of illiteracy about critical economics that has to be overcome, or we will all pay the price.
It's quite interesting. I was just thinking the other day that, you know, in our department, Marxism is something that is taught to us. And, you know, there are, I actually feel sympathy for students in other schools that are lacking that sense of context and background of a huge part of our economic intellectual heritage is completely erased from the agenda. It's, you know, sending an economics student through an economics program without learning about Marx, without learning about Keynes, is like learning English literature without learning about Shakespeare. You know, you've cut out a major part of the intellectual heritage.
Yeah, last point. I was struck by your reference to Notre Dame, because Notre Dame University did something that is really the ultimate in this. They destroyed and eradicated a heterodox, diverse economics department, one of the best in the country for opening up a dialogue, a genuine, honest, intellectual dialogue among perspectives with different radical ideas about capitalism, critical ideas, alongside the conventional celebrating capitalism kinds of economics. That gave a wonderful opportunity, intellectual opportunity to their students. They closed it down and substituted an economics department that is as narrowly focused on mainstream neoclassical economics as you could ever want. It's a real sad comment.
Yes.
We'll take a short break, and then we'll come back and continue this conversation with my guest, Keith Harrington.
I'm sitting in church in an old wooden chair. I knew nobody would look for me there. Sorrow and pity rule the earth and the skies. Looking for nothing in anyone's eyes. Once I had pretty girls did me wrong. I'm marching to the city, and the road ain't long. Snowflakes are falling around my head. Lord have mercy, they feel heavy like lead. I've been hit too hard, seen too much. Once I had a pretty gal, she done me wrong. Now I'm marching to the city, and the road ain't long. Loneliness got a mind of its own. The more people around, the more you feel alone. Changing you like a silent slave, trying to break free out of this dark cave. Once I had a pretty girl, done me wrong. Now I'm marching to the city.
Back, and I want to pick up with Keith by asking you, what would you ideally like to see colleges and universities in the United States do in terms of dealing with our economic crisis and our economic system in a way that is open to change? Fantasize a little bit with us as what you hope to accomplish and what I assume the new Economics Institute also wants to achieve.
Well, the fundamental thing that has interested me in my work, one of the things that I particularly latched onto when I was enrolling in school and looking at schools, was just curricular change. Not only are we lacking this critical, the critical Marxist legacy of thought, as you were just mentioning, but there are a whole range of new economic ideas from ecological economics, not necessarily new, it's been taught for many years, to issues that you are working on yourself, trying to investigate worker ownership, to alternate financial institutions, to alternate global rules. Having courses that focus on these important concepts is also important to pushing forward, as I said, a national movement that is built around them. We need an intellectual foundation for them. One of the courses that I particularly want to see in economics departments across the country would be ecological economics, focusing on the growth issue. You've had guests on the show before talking about the fact that our economics is currently blind to the limits, biological limits to growth on this planet. You know, it is a maximizing system. It is continuously focused on growth. In my own economics department, when you discuss issues of growth, it's a particularly sensitive topic. Even on the left, the concept that there are limits to growth is something that isn't widely acknowledged, and it's very hard to accept. So getting ecological economics at the top of curricula, seeing that that is one of the major challenges of the 21st century from a curricular front, I think is particularly important.
I've encountered this, if I could interject, in another way that you might find interesting. In Europe, particularly in the economies of Europe, like the Germans and the French and so on, that are closest to the United States in their overall functioning, there's one very glaring difference. Workers in those countries do, on average, 20% less hours of paid work per year than their American counterparts. It's as if the United States was determined to make everybody work as much as possible, way more hours than people and workers in Europe do, in a rush to produce as much as possible. Whereas the European worker have basically forced the employer to accept a much shorter work week. 20% means one of the days of the week that Americans are working, Europeans are resting, because they don't want to produce more. They want to take their growing productivity in the form of leisure. But it's not just leisure in the sense that I'm not working. It's also acknowledging limits to growth and saying we can improve our standard of living not by keeping up using up the resources of the world, but by living our lives in a different way and using more of the time for relationships and activities in our families and our neighborhoods, which they do by limiting the work week. Is there any kind of way to bring that to the American people?
Bringing in limits to growth.
Yes, and opening up these kinds of conversations.
Absolutely. I mean, the concept of the limits to growth or a course based on, for instance, steady state economics is perhaps more along the lines of what you were talking about. You know, we have to figure out not just meeting the environmental challenges or the biophysical challenges, but we also have to figure out if we are going to move away from an economy that is continuously based on growth, there's a whole range of different ways that we're going to have to reorient the way that we do business, the way that we divide up our work and leisure time, etc. There are a range of different research questions that need to be taken on under this banner of steady state economics. I'd encourage people to actually look up the Center for the Advancement of the Steady State Economy. They have a new book out called Enough is Enough, and it actually looks at some of these issues that you were just referring to, is how do we square our society with this new orientation towards economic growth.
It is rather stunning, if you think about it, that at a time when more and more people are aware of the environmental and ecological limits to production, that the reality most Americans find themselves in their workplace is that more and more work is demanded of them. The work week is longer. The work day is longer. It's as if we're not only not protecting the environment by stopping production or slowing it, we're doing the opposite. We're actually pressing more and more work out of people and using up the ecological environmental resources in an almost absurd contradiction to what we say we want to be more sensitive to.
It's absolutely
sort of astonishing. Okay, let me put to you the question often asked me and often asked my guests. What would you say to people who listen to what you've told us today, who say they agree? What can I do about it? What can I do? Where can I go? With whom can I get together to make a difference, to begin to change the very situation you've been discussing? What would you say to those folks with those questions?
Well, right now we're building, as I said, the New Economics Institute is trying to grow a national student network of organizations that will pressure their economics departments, pressure the trustees, the decision makers at the universities to change the curriculum. Not just change the curriculum, but also make certain institutional changes, such as making their schools anchor institutions for growing worker co-ops, for divesting from investments in companies that are causing some sort of social or environmental harm, to their banking practices, taking money. There's an emerging movement through the Responsible Endowments Coalition called Move Your Money, to take money out of the big banks that are actually funding the economic catastrophe, driving the economic catastrophe, tearing communities apart, to put it into community banks that are investing that money, keeping it locally, growing local wealth. So there's a range of organizations out there like Responsible Endowments Coalition that are already working on campuses to try to create some of these avenues for institutional change at the universities. But what we're trying to do at the New Economics Institute is bring together work that's being done, for instance, on that divestment and endowments front, bringing together work that students are doing to try to make their campuses greener, more energy efficient, to mobilize students to pressure elected officials for climate and clean energy policies, bringing those various strands, which are new economy efforts. If you're trying to change our energy system, if you're trying to change the way that universities spend and use their money, you are talking about reorienting the economy. Helping those folks realize that they are part of a broader network, a broader movement, and trying to highlight the fact that these various strands are new economy efforts and ideas. And we have tried to kick off this effort through a what we're calling our series of campus new economy summits this spring. People can go to the New Economics Institute online and check out the campus network. There's a list of summits that are going to be focusing on these issues. One of them is at the New School on the 13th of April, Saturday. You can go to the New Economy Network, or I'm sorry, New Economics Institute's website and click on the link through to our page where you can register, and you can register for any of these other events that are taking place across the country.
Okay, it's very interesting, I think, that we're seeing a rebirth and a rebuilding of pressures to get our universities to be more open to the whole question of economic change. I think it's another sign that more and more Americans are becoming aware of the limits, the problems, the weaknesses of the economic system we have. And after all, I think you will agree that an economic system is only as good and as acceptable as it serves the people
Absolutely.
Who live there. And if we can do better than our capitalist system, we ought to be exploring how to do that. And the only way to do that is to have an honest conversation about that system, its strengths and weaknesses, to put aside the last 50 years where we haven't done that in this country, and play long overdue catch up.
Absolutely.
I want to thank you again, Keith, for joining us.
Thank you.
Keith Harrington of the New Economics Institute. This is a sign of change in the United States that people have wanted to see. You're part of that. So our thanks to you, as well as thanks for coming today.
Thank you.
As often, folks, in the final segment of this program, I do two things. The first is to talk to you a little bit about an example of a workers' self-directed enterprise, an exact concrete example of workers, both in the United States and abroad, both in large industries and in small workshops, who have decided that they would rather work in a non-capitalist way, to organize their work, their lives, around a different model of how you do business. And this one I chose, it's called the South Mountain Company, located on Martha's Vineyard, an island off of the coast of Massachusetts, that some of you may know. That's been around a long time, and they have an interesting story, and I want to summarize that story. You can find out more about them, which I will urge you to do for a particular reason in a moment. Anyway, the South Mountain Company was founded in 1975. It is devoted to architecture, engineering, building homes, interiors, woodworking, everything having to do with quality construction of buildings in a whole variety of ways, making them energy efficient, environmentally friendly. An interesting design and building company. They have 30 employees, so they have gotten larger over time. They've been very successful. But what I want to stress is something they did in 1987. They converted from a more conventional, capitalistically organized enterprise, a proprietorship under the law, and became instead an employee workers co-op. So the first lesson of this successful company is that they weren't started as a co-op, but they decided to change. They voted with their feet against the capitalist structure that they had begun with and that they had learned to work with, and moved to something they hoped back in 1987 would work better for them and work better for their clients and work better for their community. In 1987, and here we are, 26 years later, and they've stuck with that model because they decided they had made the right move. They are a workers' co-op. They are worker-owned. They are not responsible to anyone else other than themselves, their clients, and their community. There's no shareholders out there that they have to please. There's no board of directors other than themselves and the people they choose to play that role. I would urge you to go, if you can, to their website, southmountain.com, because there they do something unusual. They lay out for you all of the documents, the rules governing how they work as a workers' co-op, what they're meaning by the term, we aren't a conventional capitalist enterprise. We are a successful example of how and why we will be more productive, more community responsible, more happy as human beings in our families if we have a democratically run enterprise rather than the capitalist hierarchical top-down enterprise we once were. And I think that's an extraordinary opportunity to learn about it. And they've been extraordinarily generous in making their internal documents and how they function available for you to see on the web. And for those of you thinking of moving in that direction, either with a new enterprise or with an existing enterprise that thinks it could be organized in a better way, here's an example that will both inspire and instruct you in very useful ways. In the time that remains to me, I want to deal with some of your questions because they're very good this week, particularly, and they allow me to talk about some things that have been on my mind and your mind, as I can tell from your comments and your questions. So here's what I want to talk about. First, the difference between Obamacare and the public option, like you have in Canada and other countries where there's a kind of generalized public insurance for everybody. Well, think of it this way. Think of it as, in one case, a capitalism run wild that can charge virtually whatever it wants, and we all have to pay. That's really what Obamacare is. What Obamacare does is try to extend medical insurance to more people. That's the good part of the news. But the bad part is it doesn't try to do anything about the crazy costs of our medical care. Four kinds of companies, four industries dominate in this country, control medical care. The doctors, the hospitals, the drug companies, and the medical insurance companies. Those are the four. And they've worked out a deal amongst themselves, and there are tensions amongst them, heaven knows. But they've worked out a deal amongst themselves, so they all do pretty well at the expense of us, the people, and the companies who buy medical care for their employees, and those of us who buy it for ourselves. The United States has the most expensive medical care in the world as a result of this. Nobody else is even close. We pay more. Do we get better medical outcomes? No. Let me say that again. Our longevity, our number of kids who die the first year of their lives, the number of days a year we spend on average in the hospital, however you measure medical outcomes. Our outcomes are mediocre. They're not the worst, they're not the best. But we pay off the chart. If ever we had an example of how private enterprise doesn't do the work, that's it. We overpay for our medical care. And a public option, a really national program, might rein in those costs because that's what's happened everywhere they exist. Medical care in Canada is much cheaper. Medical care in France, in Germany, in Italy, I can continue. It's all cheaper. Their outcomes are as good or better than ours, but they pay less. That's because they have a national health insurance. We don't do that. We can't get there. Obamacare could not rein in the costs. That's the issue. And by the way, it's across the board. In France, just to take an example, here's the law. When you go to work, your employer must give you 5 weeks of paid vacation. Let me say that again, because so many of my audience don't know it and can hardly believe it. In the United States, by contrast, there is no obligation for your employer to ever give you paid vacation. The same applies to paternity and maternity leave. In most countries, you are required as an employer to give your employees paid leave to take care of their kids, often lasting a year. We don't have that in the United States, period. No such requirement. Capitalism exists in those countries as it does here, but it's a limited, constrained capitalism. Germany, by the way, is a perfect example. And the Germans are having a much easier time of this crisis than we are. So when you hear, oh, we can't afford that because it would hurt our economy, the Germans afford it, and they're doing a lot better in their economic crisis than we are in ours. The last point I have time for today. The question of the minimum wage. Many of you have written to me asking, obviously because you have seen it in the news or read about it, because you pay attention and I want to commend you for doing it. You've asked me the question, can't sometimes raising the minimum wage cause poverty or hurt people? Let's give an answer to that question. First part of the answer is yes. It is possible that if you raise the minimum wage, there will be some employers who, rather than pay their workers an extra buck an hour or whatever it is that you're raising the wage to, would fire them. Are there some workers that will be in that situation? And the answer is yes, there are some workers. But it doesn't follow, not at all, that those workers are the end of the story, and that therefore raising the minimum wage has simply caused some poor workers to lose their jobs. To present it that way is dishonest. Why? Let me explain. Because alongside the few workers who may lose their jobs because the minimum wage is raised, we have to ask the question, what happens economically as a result of all of those workers who got a lower minimum wage having kept their job and now being paid more when the minimum wage was raised? Let's see. All of those workers, and everyone admits most workers affected by a rising minimum wage will keep their jobs and get paid more. Only a small number will lose them. Well, all those who keep their jobs and get paid more, having more money by a higher minimum wage, will be spending more money in the stores and the offices where they work and shop. Wow, if all those people with a higher minimum wage spend more money, there'll be more jobs in the stores where they spend that money. There'll be more jobs in the factories producing what a higher minimum wage will allow those workers to afford. And you have to count those two. And when you put these two things together, no one knows in advance that it won't be the case that those extra jobs created by a higher minimum wage will not, as they often have been, much larger in number than those who have lost their job because of a higher minimum wage. And if the government cared, and if the government was committed, and we didn't want people to suffer, here's an easy solution. The government could come in and say, any worker who can show that he or she lost their job because they were paid a lower minimum wage and their employer wouldn't raise it when the minimum wage legally was raised will be given a government job at the new minimum wage, the higher one, to do any one of a number of things that our government needs to do for us. from rebuilding our central cities to cleaning our streets to taking care of our daycare needs to helping with the elderly. Lots of useful things to do. We know that the numbers are relatively small. Here's the way we could make sure that we get all the benefits of a raised minimum wage and without even the small number that conservatives and right-wingers like to focus on to hold back raising the minimum wage. The only beneficiary of keeping the minimum wage there are businesses that want to underpay their employees. The rest of us do not benefit, and we watch something that is fundamentally cruel and unjust. Thank you, as always, for your attention. I appreciate your coming and watching this program and listening to this program. This is Weekly Economic Update. I'm Richard Wolff, and I look forward to being with you again next week.
Your time now, baby. But after a while, it's gonna be my time, babe. They ain't gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change, change. They ain't gonna change. Yes, it is. Change. Got the blues.